This is a CBC podcast. If you have an iPhone or an iPod Touch, make sure to download the CBC Radio app. It makes it easy to access CBC's live radio streams and on-demand shows. Find it at the App Store today.
Well, the Irish, just briefly, north and south, they have to be the friendliest people on earth. You ask them for directions, you get a full geography lesson, but it is good to be back in Canada. The economy there in the south of Ireland is very touch and go right now, and it's the worst in living memory. And the one thing I heard about Canada when I was in Ireland was our finance minister was in Dublin. He was on the radio that day describing why we didn't bail the banks out. So that's the interest in Canada that I heard about there. But we have more on that a little bit later. The fallout over the HST continues, and today reporters were hoping to hear from the man at the center of the controversy, BC Premier Gordon Campbell. He was on vacation last week when the news broke that bureaucrats had been having discussions about the HST long before the last election. And since then, some Liberal insiders have been calling on the Premier to step aside for the good of the party. And CBC legislative reporter Stephen Smart has been following this story. Hello, Stephen.
Mark, how are you?
I'm okay, and I bet you're trying to hunt down the Premier. What do you know of his whereabouts today?
Well, yeah, we all have been. That's sort of the goal of the day over here in the legislative press gallery. And, you know, all last week we were led to believe from a number of different people that the Premier was off on his summer vacation, which he often usually takes in August, but would be back today. And lo and behold, we saw what kind of a week it was for him and for his party last week, and then more criticism from inside the party over the weekend, and all of a sudden he's actually still now on holidays for a couple of days. So we have yet to hear from the Premier, as many believe the foundations of support for his party are continuing to crumble.
Maybe that's why he's staying away on a longer vacation now,
yeah,
but you never know.
and
what are you expecting from Gordon Campbell after all this speculation, and when you do get a microphone in front of him, what are you expecting to hear?
Well, if he holds true to sort of his previous statements, and as Colin Hanson, the deputy premier and finance minister, did last week, that he's going to say that I would imagine that he is still confident in what he's doing, that you know, that they still believe they did the right thing with the HST. They'll probably once again sort of admit they didn't roll it out in a very politically good way. But other than that, be very surprised if he came out and said, "Oh yeah, no, I'm stepping down," or anything like that. But you know, the calls are increasing for him to do that. It was interesting over the weekend to hear from Scott Nelson, the former mayor of Williams Lake, who was fairly high up within the Liberal Party, as you know, was well reported on CBC over the past couple of days, calling on Campbell to step down. And this was a guy who wasn't just sort of a hanger-on within the party. I mean, he was quite high up in the party. He chaired the Liberals' provincial council for several years, and to have someone like that calling on the Premier to step down for the good of the party, that's a big deal, and it would have been nice to have heard a response from the Premier on it today.
Yes, I think the Premier even stayed at his home when he was on the campaign trail in the Cariboo there. So the clock is ticking, though, isn't it? We have coming up in November the party convention, and what are some of the options here before the Premier, do you think?
Yeah, and that's going to be an interesting convention. So the lead up to the convention, what people should know is that Liberal Party members will be sort of casting ballots over the next month or so. They'll be sealed until the convention, but asking whether they still endorse the Premier's leadership. And in the past, he's had sort of 80% to 90% of people say, "Yep, absolutely, we support Gordon Campbell." Many of those insiders are questioning whether, well, it'll be anywhere near that level of support this year. So, I mean, it's going to be very telling, Mark, what happens over the next couple of months. I mean, you know, if you had asked about this a couple of weeks ago, we probably would have said, well, you know, there's some internal grumbling, internal dissent over the HST. You know, obviously there was Blair Leckstrom stepping down a few months ago, but that it was just grumbling. And now, over the past week, after after the those documents were released last week under Freedom of Information, after you had the Liberal Riding Association president out in Rich Coleman's riding openly criticizing the government, and then on the weekend, Scott Nelson up in Williams Lake criticizing the government, you know, you have to ask, what's next? And that what's next will really play a big role in determining what's going to happen in November. I mean, who knows what else is going to take place before then?
Must be interesting discussions at the legislature amongst the reporters and the other politicos. What is some speculation about what could happen? Let's imagine that he did say, okay, he tells us in November he's going to step aside in the spring. Does that mean you look for an interim leader or what?
Well, speculation, and you know, there's a little bit of dissent on this, but the speculation that I've heard most, Mark, is that if he was going to do that, and I have yet to hear anything definitive that he is going to announce anything this fall, but if he was, he would probably stay on, and then a leadership race would happen. You know, if he was to announce it in the fall, a leadership race would probably happen sometime in the spring, although that conflicts with the fact the legislature is supposed to sit in the spring. And one of the things the NDP have been out saying is you know, what a distraction this is. Could you imagine anything actually getting done with a leadership race happening in the meantime? It sort of, it really distracts from the business of government, and there's a lot of that that needs to happen as well, namely the HST petition, which is going to roll along this fall. You've got you know, the Van der Zaan folks talking about starting recall efforts in November. I mean, there's a lot going on, and a leadership race would be a big distraction, so you'd think that people within the party would be trying to limit those distractions as much as they can. But, you know, given the events of the past week and what's bound to continue, you know, don't count anything out in terms of what might happen.
Okay, well, the Premier is on holidays longer than you and others thought. What's the expectation? When will he face that first scrum, do you think?
Well, there is a cabinet meeting on Thursday morning here in Victoria. It'll be the first one in over a month or so, first one since the end of summer, sort of unofficial summer holidays at least. So that is scheduled for 10 a.m. on Thursday morning. So he will be here for that. So, you know, we'd obviously like to talk to him before then, and the public, I'm sure, would be very interested to hear what he has to say about everything that's been going on. But Thursday morning at 10 a.m., we should finally be able to speak to the Premier and get his take on just a bit of a remarkable events in his government's in this third term so far.
Good talking to you, Stephen. Thank you.
You too, Mark.
CBC legislative reporter Stephen Smart in Victoria, and you can get more on this story all day on CBC Radio, also online at cbc.ca, and on television starting at 5 o'clock this evening. You're listening to a podcast repeat of BC Almanac, heard on CBC Radio 1. Today is the first day of school for most kids around our province. Some students dealing with school closures due to shrinking enrollments, while others returning to overcrowded hallways and portables. And in a few minutes, we'll hear what it's like in a Surrey school with 16 portables. But first, we are off to Dunster in the Robson Valley to find out what's happened to students following the closure of the Dunster Fine Arts School. And Seth McDonald is online from Dunster. He's the president of the Dunster Fine Arts School Society. Seth, welcome to BC Almanac today.
Hi, Mark. Thanks for having us on.
We did speak with a Dunster parent back at the end of June, and the school was closing then. And what are you doing now that the school has actually closed?
Well, we have actually never recognized Dunster Fine Arts School being closed, even though the building is boarded up and they have removed all belongings from the school. And as you may or may not know, some of us parents occupied the school after the closure in June and were served with an injunction, thereby removing us from the property. So at this point, having not been allowed transfer of the building or property, or not being allowed back on the property or in the building, we are setting up a temporary tent school adjacent to the property.
A tent school?
Yes.
It sounds like a gold rush encampment or something.
Well, when you're forced into these circumstances, that's basically all you can do. And this is a very temporary measure because we trust that the Honorable Margaret McDermott will do everything within her power to facilitate the transfer of the building and property from District 57.
Will you have classes in the tent school? And
yes, we plan to resume classes. We don't actually have any teaching budget or anything like that. So everything is going to be volunteer, and we will have the former drama teacher there tomorrow teaching classes, as well as all of the parents of the kids that will be attending.
How many kids will be there?
We're hoping for 9 to 10 children tomorrow. We had 27 at the closing day of school this year in June, but because of the closure and no promise to reopen from the district, a lot of parents have been forced to enroll their children in McBride or Villemount, and some parents have even been forced to move.
And that's a 45-minute run on the bus for those kids, I take it?
That's correct.
Roughly. Your own 7-year-old, if the school doesn't reopen, will you put your child into the McBride school?
I will not. And we will be reopening the school in one way or another. We're the oldest school in the district. We've had a school here in Dunster for 94 years. It's always been community run. Listeners should know that this school property was donated to the original McBride and Robson Valley School District by community members. And half of the school was actually built from previous insurance money from a fire before it was involved in any school district. We also built the playground with our own money and the tennis court and the skating rink.
And just in closing then, what promise do you have from the minister that there will be a school there again?
Well, back in June when we basically left the building due to, well, both factors, the fact that we were served with an injunction making us criminals if we stayed there, apparently, according to the affidavit. But the biggest reason that we actually left the party was due to a promise from Minister McDermott that they would help to facilitate the transfer of the building and property into the hands of at that time it was the regional district who was going to act on our behalf, or a third party for educational or community use.
Seth, we're going to follow this story with you, and our time is gone right now for this discussion, but thanks for joining me. Good luck with the tent school tomorrow.
Thank you.
Seth McDonald, president of the Dunster Fine Arts School Society, as well as a parent with school-age children. Now we're heading to the Lower Mainland now to Surrey, the province's fastest-growing school district. And earlier today, I spoke with Hala Youssef. She's a grade 10 student at Fraser Heights Secondary. Her school tops the district with 16 portables, and I asked her about the overcrowding at the school.
It's really, really packed. Like, there's even more grade 8s than usual, so even the cafeteria, it's just packed.
And I understand that you have actually 16 portables there, is that right?
Yeah, like we have the school, and then away from the school we have like a little pod of portables.
And how many of your classes are going to be in the portables?
I have, in the first semester I have 2, and in the second semester I think I have 3.
And what are the portables like?
Well, it's not very nice. Some of them smell really bad. And then I get headaches, so it's that. And they're really hot, and then they're really cold in the winter.
What do they smell like?
It's, like, musty, like, because it's when it rains, I guess it, like, people go in with their shoes, and then the carpets get all, like, wet, and then they dry, and then it's just, they only clean them once a year, too, like the carpets.
So you don't like them. What are other students saying about being in portables this year?
Everyone hates them. I don't know one person that likes the portables, because they're not, like, even... We have a hill that we have to go down, and then when it's snowing, you can, like, you fall and get wet, and then you have to go and sit in wet clothes for the rest of the day.
But, Hala, it's only 2 classes. It's not like you have to spend the whole day there.
I know, but still, if we have double block days, we have to be there for, like, 2.5 hours.
What's happening to your school population there, Hala? What do you know about how many students are there this year compared to last year?
Well, there's more grade 8s than we had last year. I don't really know why, but there is more grade 8s than we had last year.
And how many portables did you have last year?
I think we had the same amount, but then 2 years ago we got more. We got like a new pack.
So how are you going to deal with this, do you think, if you have to stick it out in these portables for the rest of the school year?
I don't know. I'll just have to suck it up, I guess.
Okay, Hella. Good luck doing that. Good luck with your studies, too.
Okay, thank you.
Thank you.
Bye.
Bye. Hella Youssef, grade 10 student at Fraser Heights Secondary in Surrey. And online with me now is Doug Strachan with the Surrey School District. Good afternoon, Doug.
Hi, Mark.
How much of a problem is overcrowding this year for your district?
Well, we have portables on a number of sites, but some of them are related to seismic or other construction on a temporary basis. We have about 55 sites with portables, but 32 of those have less than five. So it really is a reflection of the growth of certain communities that we have, like Fraser Heights, where there's 16 portables. So there are a few schools in that category, not quite 16, but certainly 10 or more.
What are you trying to do to remedy that?
Well, as in the case of Fraser Heights, it's been at the top of our capital plan wish list for about 5 years now. So we need to depend on the ministry to provide us the funding to go ahead with a school expansion. In the meantime, and the board has been very active and public in communicating to the ministry the concerns of parents and students like Hala, that there's a need to have capital construction, new schools going forward. There have been a number of new schools brought online, built and opened over the last 5 or 6 years, but our growth hasn't let up. And in fact, last year, our rate of growth increased, and there hasn't been new capital construction for schools approved for about 5 years.
And that comes directly from the province, I take it.
That's right.
Okay.
But the minister herself came and visited the district in the spring this year. And, we're hearing in some school districts, of course, the problems faced with closures. We have been receding enrollment, and our district's rather phenomenal growth is a success story, but of course it carries with it its own challenges. And the minister has been frank in recognizing that and visited with the board and toured the district this spring and provided a one-time grant of $2 million to help us out for the interim.
Doug, what about the state of some of these portables? Hala says they're smelly and moldy.
Well, the portables at Fraser Heights have been there for a while, as Hala points out. And there is maintenance done to those portables as well as all our school buildings quite regularly. But in the end, you are talking about portable classrooms. And as she pointed out, traipsing through the rain or snow and slush into the classroom is something that we're faced with through the winter primarily. And it's not ideal, as Hala pointed out as well, the effect on the school facilities such as the theater, the cafeteria, facilities like that is definitely, they're taxing the ability for the school and the space that's available.
Yes, and here's hoping the learning doesn't suffer as well. Doug, thank you very much for this time right now.
Thank you.
That's Doug Strachan with the Surrey School District, and we'd love to hear from you on this topic. If you're a parent, a teacher, or a student dealing with overcrowding or school closures, email us directly, almanac@cbc.ca. Well, truly a tragic weekend for a young couple from BC. Aaron and Brian Wood were driving on Whidbey Island in Washington State when an oncoming Chevy Blazer crossed the center line. Brian was killed in the crash. His pregnant wife survived. And here's Aaron describing to CBC News how her husband's response behind the wheel probably saved her life.
I do know that the officers and everyone that have been investigating said that Brian did the only thing that could have been done to ever give me a chance at surviving, which was at the very last second, he braked incredibly hard and turned right to put himself fully in the path of the vehicle. And that's what, because he braked so hard, the vehicle kind of went up and over us instead of a head-on. And if it would have been head-on, we both would have definitely been dead. So he definitely decided at that very split second to sacrifice himself to save me and the baby.
Erin Wood, she is 6 months pregnant. Her physical condition after the crash is improving. And Washington State Police think drugs were involved in this. The driver and a passenger in the Blazer could be facing vehicular homicide charges. Two other men were killed riding in the back of that vehicle. 12:30, 1:30 in the Mountain Time Zone, and BC, one of three provinces, introducing all-day kindergarten for 4 and 5-year-olds starting today. We want to know how you're feeling about sending your youngster off to school for the full day. Plus, new measures to combat human trafficking. That's coming up after our CBC News update. Here's Susan McNamee.
Good afternoon. The Integrated Homicide Investigation Team has made an arrest 5 months after the body of a man was found in an abandoned vehicle in New Westminster. Police say they knew 67-year-old Patrick LeBlanc of Vancouver was murdered somewhere else, but it wasn't until they identified a warehouse in Vancouver as the murder location that they started piecing the case together. Police had to go to Brandon, Manitoba last week to arrest 38-year-old Russell Benson, and then went to Ontario to arrest 28-year-old Glenn Anhert in the Niagara area. Both have been charged with second-degree murder. Close to 200 people who lost their jobs when Carrier Lumber permanently shut down its sawmill in Valemont in eastern BC will be getting millions of dollars in severance pay. The United Steelworkers Union says the Labor Relations Board has rejected the company's appeal of a severance package awarded to the workers after the mill was closed last year. Marty Gibbons of the union says it's a huge win for working people in resource communities. And police say a plane that crashed near Mabel Lake east of Vernon on Sunday was only in the air a few minutes before it crashed and burned, killing both men aboard. Gord Molendijk of the RCMP says 53-year-old Thomas Hewer was piloting the plane and his 45-year-old brother Joseph was a passenger. In the weather on the south coast, a mix of sun and cloud today, possible showers or thunder showers later today. For the central interior, cloudy periods tonight with a 30% chance of showers. Up in the Peace, periods of rain tonight, a low of 6. And for the southern interior, cloudy with sunny periods tomorrow with a 40% chance of showers and a high of 17. For more on these stories, you can go to the web, cbc.ca/bc. And please join me at 5:30 today for BC Today, right here on CBC Radio 1, 690 AM, 88.1 FM in Vancouver. And from Dublin to Vancouver, here's Mark Forsyth.
Thank you very much. It was a great trip. And if you've never been to Northern Ireland, the Antrim coastline, 5 shamrocks at least. It is stunning, the Giant's Causeway and the glens around Cushendall and that.
Oh,
great trip.
Making me envious. I'm sure it was great.
And the Guinness really is creamier in Ireland.
And you've got it on your T-shirt.
Thank you. 94.1 FM in Kamloops as well is how you can tune us in here on CBC Radio 1. Well, there's a new federal initiative announced today aiming to help all of us become more aware of the signs and signals that a person is a victim of human trafficking. The Public Safety Minister, Vic Tave, spoke today about the new Crime Stoppers and RCMP awareness campaign. And in just a few minutes, we'll hear from Canada's foremost authority on human trafficking. But first, here's the minister.
Canada is not immune to this global crime, and together through increased awareness, we can all help make a difference. Because of the clandestine nature of human trafficking, Canada, like most countries around the world, has very little data on the extent of human trafficking within our borders. Victims are forced, often through violence and threats, to provide their services or labor because of their fear of their safety or that of someone else. The majority are forced to work in the sex industry and are led to a life of exploitation, deprived of basic human rights. Most are women and children, and their cases often go unnoticed and unreported due to threats from offenders, language barriers, or mistrust of authorities.
There's the Public Safety Minister, Vic Tave, speaking this morning on this new initiative to raise awareness of the growing problem of human trafficking. Benjamin Perrin is a professor of law at the University of British Columbia. His new book is called Invisible Chains, Canada's Underground World of Human Trafficking. He's launching a website today on the issues around human trafficking. And welcome back to BC Almanac today, Professor.
Hi there.
What do you think of this particular initiative, this new one from the federal government, to educate us, the general public, about how to identify these human trafficking situations?
Well, these sort of campaigns that we know from other countries are absolutely a critical part of the plan. If people are not aware of the warning signs of this sort of crime, which is very difficult to detect even for some trained investigators, these cases go unreported. And the consequences of that are that victims continue to be exploited in our communities. The Blue Blindfold campaign that the minister announced today is borrowed, really, part of an international campaign that began in the United Kingdom, so it's got some international connections to it. And the idea is that more and more people who become aware of the problem, they can report it now to Crime Stoppers, who are trained to identify those same warning signs.
So you like the sounds of this. And what are some examples? What could people be looking for that would help them realize that this could be human trafficking?
Well, we know in Canada from over 3 years of research that we have completed for this upcoming book, Invisible Chains, that people who are exploited in Canada have really been held hostage in situations where they're literally right next door to average Canadians. We've had cases of human trafficking where victims have been exploited in condominiums, what we call micro brothels that are embedded in our communities, in not just the seedy end of town like people may think, but in high-end condos in major Canadian cities. We've also seen cases where people have been exploited as live-in caregivers, as child care workers, as hotel workers. The list goes on and on and on. That's why this concept of the chains that these people are suffering under being really invisible to the untrained eye is one that we want to drive home.
Okay, I'm in a hotel, and I see a worker. What are some clues that this person may be part of the problem?
Well, certainly the inability to identify a number of factors is what's holding us back. So no one factor is sufficient, but it's a combination of factors. So, for example, if the person doesn't speak have no knowledge of English or French or the language that's spoken in the area that you're in, again, that alone is not enough, but combined with some other things could be a factor you're concerned about. If you suddenly notice the same hotel workers were working the morning shift as the evening shift, those long hours is another warning sign. If the individual does not make eye contact with you, their eyes are down, they appear to be dejected. Together, these things begin to accumulate. And certainly, once people begin to find these warning signs, they are able now to report them. Before, if you'd called Crime Stoppers and said, I was at a hotel, there was someone there who wouldn't look me in the eye, they didn't seem to speak English or French, and I've seen them there for 4 days in a row, working every single shift that I've ever walked through the hotel in. Before, you may have been told, well, that's not enough for us to go on. Now, because these are basic warning signs, it's enough for at least a tip to be made to Crime Stoppers and an investigation potentially to start. So this crime really requires average Canadians to find out about these warning signs. And in cases just like that, that's how victims were identified. A recent case in the Vancouver area that is documented in Invisible Chains talks about this, where people found this victim when they were finally able to go to church one Sunday. They saw some of these very same warning signs.
So tell us just how these underworld groups managed to target and control these people.
Well, and particularly one of the major problems we're dealing with in Canada is sex trafficking of Canadian victims. This astounds many people when they hear about it, but time and time again, during our three-year research study, we came across these sort of cases. And one of the main problems that we have here is that many times these people are simply dismissed as, in many cases, they're called teenage prostitutes. And people don't realize that lurking behind them in the shadows, literally on the street corner, or when they're being sold online, there's someone back there who's controlling them. And some of the methods of control, they range from outright physical violence. When that doesn't work, traffickers in Canada have used threats against loved ones to keep their victims compliant. And on the other hand, we have traffickers who've never laid a finger of violence on their victims. They deceive them into believing that they're their boyfriend and that all this money is going to some sort of future trust fund for them or for future savings purposes. But in reality, of course, the money's been taken away by that criminal.
Haven't you described pimping, really?
Well, that's the common word we have in North America for trafficking. It's a cute sort of cultural label. People go to pimp and hoe parties. There's something called Pimp Juice, which is a rap star Nelly put out. It's a very popular kind of concept. When I worked in Cambodia on this issue, they had their cultural label too. It was called a mama son. That was a Vietnamese word for what we call a trafficker. So we have to get past these cultural labels and call this crime what it is. And it's a form of modern-day slavery where people are unable to leave these circumstances. And it's hopeful that campaigns like this one that was launched today will help inform Canadians about this problem. Traffickers depend on people, quote-unquote, minding their own business. What the Crime Stoppers Blue Blindfold campaign does is encourage us all to take the blindfolds off, see the invisible chains that these victims are being controlled by, and do our part to begin the process of rescuing these people.
I believe you made a call yourself in the Okanagan on this?
That's right. I was aware of the campaign. They've been training the Crime Stoppers officers for about a year now to make sure they all were aware of these warning signs. And, I can't get into the details, obviously, since it's an ongoing case. It was enough of an accumulation of warning signs for me to be concerned to call and made that call to the Crime Stoppers hotline in the Kelowna area, in between there and Penticton. And I would have to say I was very impressed. The officer who took the call really knew what he was talking about. He clearly had been trained and took the details down as seriously as any other crime would be. And, of course, with Crime Stoppers, it's anonymous. So it's valuable to report there. But if people are willing to go on the record, they can also call their local police station and let them know.
And what makes you think people will actually respond to this and report?
Well, I think that Canadians are generally very compassionate people. And unfortunately, we're... Slavery has been able to thrive globally. It's because people often don't know about it. When people become aware of how violent these criminals are who are perpetrating the crime, that they're often involved as well in drugs and weapons trafficking offenses, that this is a crime which deserves to be eradicated in Canada today. It's not the sort of thing we want to see happening in our communities. And these victims really need help to come forward. They can't make that call on their own. And in many cases where they have, they've paid very dearly for that. So we need to step forward. And when we see these warning signs, offer to help.
Good to talk to you today. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Mark Forsyth. This is a podcast repeat of BC Almanac from CBC Radio 1.
Back to school day for most kids in our province. And for the youngest students, a big change in the works, with full-day kindergarten being offered in about half of the schools in the province. The other half will be on board by next September. We'd love to hear from you on this. Is your son or daughter heading into all-day kindergarten this year? How are they dealing with that? How are you dealing with that? And do you think BC's 4- and 5-year-olds are well served by an all-day program? Here are the numbers to reach us directly. 1-800-825-5950. Around Vancouver, 604-669-3733. The cell, *#690. And with me is Paul Kershaw. He's an assistant professor with UBC's Human Early Learning Partnership. And welcome to BC Almanac, Professor.
Yeah, it's a pleasure to join you.
And why do you think parents should be welcoming this change today?
Well, full-day kindergarten has the potential, and let me emphasize potential, to be a small step toward what really will be the most important social policy innovation in a generation. And it has that much potential because we actually have a pretty serious problem in British Columbia and across the country. About 30% of our kids are vulnerable developmentally before they even reach kindergarten. And it is that way because our family policy isn't as effective in supporting families with young kids as it should be, and we're still, British Columbians actually don't even know about it. Not even 20% of British Columbians actually accurately know how many kids are vulnerable before they get to school.
What do you mean by vulnerable? What do we see?
Well, we look at a range of things, physical things, social and emotional competencies, and language and cognitive development. Let me give you a few examples. Children who are vulnerable sometimes don't have the fine motor skills to hold a pencil, the gross motor skills to climb stairs, the social and emotional maturity to follow a reasonable amount of time instructions from an adult or get along with peers on the playground, and they may not even know 10 letters in the alphabet.
And how does all-day kindergarten help those children directly?
Well, it starts to help children because it's starting to help families. Families need time, they need resources, and they need a range of community supports to do this important job of rearing the next generation. And full-day kindergarten is one piece of that community support because it has potential to put in place a play-based approach to learning and exploring the world in an environment that is filled with people who have a decent education, trained to do the work, paid good wages, and it's an entitlement. You don't have to have a certain amount of money to be able to get there.
But keeping children so young in school all day, what about the worry they could be dog tired by the time the day is over, having to focus that long in school?
Well, and that's a really good concern to raise. If, in fact, that's how it plays out in the next years, then full-day kindergarten won't be reaching its potential. But the documents that first proposed the idea and then explored its feasibility, and the ideas expressed by ministers who first announced it, it's really emphasizing play-based approaches. In other words, we're not talking about getting younger and younger children sitting in books, all sternly looking at their, sitting in desks, looking sternly at their books, holding a pencil for 8 hours a day. We're really talking about bringing in all the expertise from childcare and early learning and what those people know about play-based approaches to exploring the world and developing as human beings should develop, and bring that into the school system. And that's why it has so much potential.
Paul Kershaw is my guest. He's an assistant professor at UBC's Human Early Learning Partnership, and this is where we want to hear from our listeners. What do you think of all-day kindergarten? It's coming to half of our schools in the province now, and this time next year, all young children will have access to this. It will be optional as well for parents to decide. 669-3733, 1-800-825-5950, star or pound, 690 on the cell. And Annie is phoning us from Osoyoos with some thoughts on this. Hi, Annie.
Hi there.
What do you think of all-day kindergarten?
I think it's actually amazing. I mean, my daughter's been going to preschool, and then she was in all-day daycare. So I don't really think it's a big gradual step as all-day program.
What do you like about it, and what do you think your daughter likes about it?
She's going to a smaller school, so I think she's going to really enjoy the fact that, you know, the older kids are going to be helping out a lot, and she gets a lot of one-on-one time and stuff.
Paul, go ahead. Yeah.
Annie's really touched on one important thing. One thing the research shows us about putting in place quality play-based approaches to early learning and development is that the ratio between the number of adults and the number of kids needs to be kept quite modest. In childcare, it's a ratio of one adult to eight kids. UNICEF recommends not getting bigger than 1 to 10 when you're talking about five-year-olds. And that is one of the things that we need to look carefully at as full-day kindergarten unfolds, just how many adults are in the room relative to the number of kids. And right now, typically, kindergarten has had a bigger ratio than that. So Annie's really focused on a key thing.
Annie, thanks for the call and what you think of this, too. Helen Ward is joining us online right now. She is speaking out against all-day kindergarten. She's with the group Kids First Parent Association of Canada. Hello, Helen.
Hi, Paul. Hi, Mark. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, and why aren't you in support of all-day kindergarten?
Well, Paul Kershaw, his so-called research, it's junk science. This is not about what's best for children. This is about, Paul Kershaw works very closely with Clyde Hertzman, the head of the Human Early Learning Partnership, and Mr. Hertzman works for the World Bank, and that's one of the leading promoters of this kind of agenda, to put more children longer hours in institutional care settings away from their parents. Paul says that, 30% of children are vulnerable. Well, what does that mean? You asked him, but he didn't really answer you. That comes from the early development instrument, more junk science.
So what should be happening instead, Helen? What do you think should be
funding parents on an equitable basis to make the choices that they feel are in the best interest of their children and their family? Paul wants to see more money going to institutions and away from parents. He says, give parents a little bit of money and give the institutions a whole lot of money. And his claim, you know, play-based learning. Well, children learn by playing. They also learn by their attachment and by copying adults. And when you have a situation where children are spending 6 hours or more surrounded by other children, they've got very reduced contact with adults. Their language learning, their behavioral learning is reduced. Paul will tell you that the research of Dr. James Heckman, a Nobel Prize winning fellow in economics, supports what he's saying. But actually, Dr. James Heckman's research says that there is no evidence that these universal programs, such as this all-day kindergarten, have any benefit to children. Dr. Heckman proposes vouchers to families.
Yes, Helen, at the same time, you have an option as a parent to pick up your child at noon, too, right? It's not
actually
being forced on people.
That's not really clear. And the thing is, we don't have an option not to pay our taxes. And looking after your own child, you don't even get a thank you, and you certainly don't get any money for that, whereas if your child is put in an institutional setting that is heavily funded by the state, and there's no evidence to show that that's better for children. The evidence shows otherwise. Reducing the time that parents and children spend together does not improve children's outcomes.
Helen, thank you for this. We're getting lots of calls. We'd like to hear from more of our listeners, too, and that's Helen Ward with Kids First Parent Association. It's 10 before the hour. Paul Kershaw is with us yet from UBC's Human Early Learning Partnership. Let's hear from more of our listeners. Angela in Richmond on this move to all-day kindergarten. What do you think?
I think that all children should have the opportunity to be in all-day kindergarten, and I think that the government should recognize that it's penalizing parents who, in fact, cannot have their children in all-day because it's not available in their local school. I'm all in favor of all-day, and of course it has to be a good program, and of course there has to be a good ratio of teacher to children, and I think that that, of course, is the bottom line. But I do believe it should be available to all children, and I think five is quite perfectly adequate age to be in school all day. It's certainly the case in Europe, it's the case in the UK, and they have much lower illiteracy rates than we do. And I have to wonder if there isn't some connection between what we provide in the very early years in schooling and what happens to the population later on.
Well, all will have the opportunity this time next year. What, will you be pleased with that?
They're being penalized by not. In fact, she's spending more on daycare this year than she did last year because of this half-day program. And half day is only 2.5 hours. That's not really half a day. It's about a third of a day, or maybe even a quarter of a day if you look at it that way.
Okay, Paul, let's go back to you for a moment here. Where is the proof? And that was something that we heard from Helen Ward, that it's specious at best. Well, where is it?
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to have Helen Ward, who doesn't have a PhD, calling what we're doing at the Human Early Learning Partnership, where we have some of the most internationally renowned thinkers on the subject doing great research. I think we have to be a bit careful about throwing around some uncomfortable characterizations. But that said, there is an enormous amount of evidence that says children are going to thrive in quality, nurturing settings. Now, there's no doubt that attachment to adults, attachment to parents is absolutely critical. Attachment to a range of adults can be just as important. And so the bottom line is, if we can create a nurturing environment, we know children are going to thrive. The question that's reasonable put out there is, will full-day kindergarten be that nurturing environment? And if it has the right adult-to-child ratios, if it has adults with the right kind of education doing the work, if it pays them adequate wages, we know that we're going to see the right kind of quality setting.
Leah is waiting in Duncan on the island to talk about all-day kindergarten. Is it a good idea, Leah?
No, I don't think so. My daughter starts kindergarten this year, and I'm thrilled that she's going to be one of the school in our catchment area is a half day. None of my friends are for the full day. I don't know who the parents are that are for the full day. I think my child would do better being in kindergarten for half day and with me for the other half day.
Because?
Because I just think it's too long. I think a full day is too long for five-year-olds.
Well, what if it's this play-based learning and they're socializing, and as Paul is describing it, it could be beneficial to them?
It could be, but I think I provide that environment for her with getting her in different activities, dance and gymnastics. We have enough friends here that they have their different play dates with a range of, with a whole different range of different families. She does go to daycare 2 days a week, so she has attachment to other adults and in other situations and environments. And I just resent the fact that now they're saying that all kids next year, which is going to be my second child, will have to go to the full-day daycare.
Well, Paul, it'll be optional, won't it?
As far as I understand, the policy remains that it will be optional, and so it should be. I think it's critical for Leah to, on the one hand, recognize that she's pleased with the range of opportunity she's providing her child, and she finds that she has enough time to care personally to do that. One of the challenges that other families are running into is that if they're trying to straddle their earning requirements with their caring opportunities, that they're not having enough service support. And so one of the things that full-day kindergarten can begin to do is put in place one block of community services to help families juggle their earning and caring responsibilities if they don't find they can have enough time to be at home personally.
Good to hear from you, and our time is closing on this discussion right now. And Shannon at Una River on the North Coast wants to talk about this. Shannon?
Oh, hi. I'm just writing down notes as I'm listening to this. We don't have a school where I live because my kids are the only kids in our town. I just have such a problem with people, experts and scientists, talking about what is best for our own kids. We as parents should have enough time to personally care for and provide quality experiences for our kids. And if we don't, why are we having kids? Why are kids going to daycare until 6 o'clock at night every day and spending time with other adults, and I don't understand why people think this is normal or okay. I just find all of this shocking.
Yes, personally. Perhaps because some parents can't afford to do it any other way because they have to provide if they're a single parent, for instance. But, Paul, what about this? Is there also a concern here? This is a glorified daycare that we're talking about.
I think a lot of your callers today have been tapping into the fact that we need to be balancing our services with new initiatives that provide parents with time to care personally. At the Human Early Learning Partnership, we talk about both being important. It's not an either-or issue. So the full school day kindergarten has potential to improve the way the community provides services to help families. But the community also has to talk simultaneously about how it provides parents more time to care personally, and we have recommendations about that as well, around parental leave and changing how we define full-time work. But we shouldn't be critiquing kindergarten because it enriches the services but doesn't help parents find more time. We should be saying, great, kindergarten does this one part, and now we need some other policy changes to help parents have enough time to care personally.
Good to have your thoughts on this today, Paul. Thank you.
Thank you.
Paul Kershaw, Assistant Professor at UBC's Human Early Learning Partnership, and we appreciate hearing from our listeners, too. Thanks for the calls, but if you didn't get through and you want to comment, send us an email, almanac@cbc.ca. Send us your comments and story suggestions, almanac@cbc.ca.
For more on all of our CBC podcasts, head to cbc.ca/podcasting.